Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hi, it's Doug Levy, CEO of Beeline.
Doug, thanks so much for finding time to join us on the Ivy Podcast today. You are my first episode of 2021.
All right.
No pressure. No pressure on you.
No worries.
I'm going to set the right tone for the new year. Can you tell us a little bit more about your background, where you come from, your career path, and then I want to spend a couple of minutes talking about your current organization.
Okay, sure. I've been at Beeline for 20 years. I just celebrated my 20th year with the company a couple of weeks ago. Before that, I got out of school and I went into consumer products. So Pillsbury and then Conagra. So I spent 10 years there and then I made the move over to this industry. I've been there ever since.
That's exciting. So tell us a little bit more about Beeline. What problem are you guys solving through your product and services?
If you go back to when I started, which was basically 2000, you recall, you may not, you're young, but Y2K was a big problem. And everybody was concerned with the fact that the ball was going to drop and all IT systems were going to crash. And so what that did is it afforded the staffing companies a great opportunity because there was such demand and very little supply. So obviously staffing firms made a lot of money in that time frame. And then Y2K happened, the big nothing. So they had a lot of, let's say, disenfranchised procurement departments realizing they paid a lot of money that maybe was out of market rate. So enter what we call VMS, vendor management software, which in essence leveled the playing field and put job descriptions electronically to a preferred supply base and then made them compete. So in essence, it was a cost savings play. At least it started that way. Back in the early 2000s. And if you think about an applicant tracking system, which in essence sits at the enterprise or the company level and helps people go find candidates to hire, that's in essence what VMS is. Vendor management software sits in between the large enterprise and the staffing firms and basically just relays the requisition over to those staffing firms and they submit those candidates. And it's an opportunity for large companies to find talent. Always non-full-time talent, though, whether that be a contractor or a 1099 or even project-based work. So our solution, in essence, connects talent with large companies, but that talent is always on a temporary basis.
Well, that's exciting. And I personally dealt with different types of VMS systems when I was in corporate, where organizations were actually, we would start a project management office, for example, and we would have this project-based needs for a lot of contractors, consultants, project management, so forth. And, before any VMS that actually was implemented, it was kind of chaotic because we were dealing with a lot of different staffing agencies and we're getting submissions and resumes from left and right. So I can definitely see how, a product like Beeline can definitely help streamline and organize a lot of these operations from that standpoint.
Yeah, you hit it. I mean, it was cost savings, it was visibility, it was efficiency, and then compliance. Those are the four areas that we address for the enterprise.
Right, absolutely. So with building this product, I would imagine that innovation is at the core of everything that you guys do. And it's a topic that's, I'm extremely passionate about. One of my favorite professors at Harvard, still a very good friend, Stefan Tomke, he's specialized in that. And he wrote a couple of books on specifically experimentation. Experimentation matters and experimentation works, but the overarching theme is innovation. And a lot of the guests that I interview on the Ivy Podcast, one of the things that we always talk about is, building and fostering that culture of innovation. Tell me a little bit more about that. How do you go about building that culture at Beeline? What strategies or initiatives that help you to accomplish that?
Well, I appreciate you saying you got to build a culture because for me, culture is everything. It's the bedrock of whether it's innovation or even sales or implementations, operations, marketing. For us, that's absolutely everything. So, I don't necessarily subscribe to, I think everyone's out there trying to say we're the most innovative and that's fine. A lot of marketing revolves around that. We're much more circumspect in that manner in terms of trying to solve problems. So I think 20 years ago, VMS was highly innovative, right? For the reasons we just articulated. But what we have to continue to do is figure out what are the problems that our clients are suffering or that the market's suffering, because sometimes the clients don't know that they're suffering. So, you know, how do you get ahead of the thought process a bit and start to contemplate that? And I was very involved in that for many, many years. And now I'm much more involved in terms of trying to figure out where I think the market should go. And for the functional innovation, I finally basically realized that, you know, the youth is going to understand this far better than I. So I understand what problems need to be solved. But if I put that in the hands of the millennials or those even younger than them, they'll find the way. That used to be me. That's not my role anymore. So in terms of how you build a culture, I think we have to keep focusing in on what are problems that we solve and then celebrate those so that people understand that the reward and the recognition comes from solving them. It doesn't always have to be, you know, a big groundbreaking app or anything crazy. It's just got to solve problems. Now, having said that, there's still a tremendous amount of opportunity for us to innovate, obviously with machine learning and AI. And, you know, you got to say that in big data and a bunch of data science terms to get the click in the box to be a technologist. But once you get past that, I always go back to the, so what? What are we really trying to do? And there is some really interesting things that we're doing. But back to your question, you know, one of the things I've done, I don't do it every year, but every few years I'll send out, and this came from Forrest Gump, but stupid is as stupid does. So guys, just tell me, what are we doing that's stupid? Right? Because we have a lot of new faces every year. It's like, I'm sure I'm stuck in thinking in ways in the past. And like, you must come here and say, why in the heck do they do that? Mm-hmm. And you'd be amazed, John. Like some of the stuff I'm like, yeah, that is stupid. Why? And we've been doing that for 10 years. And I think that's a way you reinforce in the culture that, you know, we got to keep challenging ourselves and trying to figure out, is there a better way and not just sitting by with the status quo.
Right, right. Absolutely. No, I love that. And I love those examples. And at the end of the day, sounds like it all boils down to what problem are we solving for our customer and how is our product going to make our customer better? Because right. At the end of the day, it's, you know, nobody cares about your product. Nobody even, you know, as they say, even your mom doesn't care about your product. Right. If your product doesn't make your customer better. I love that. I recently read a blog post by one of the VCs where he talks about this concept of Super Mario. It's kind of Super Mario marketing, so to say, where basically your customer is this little Mario that runs around, you know, just collects whatever the coins.
Yeah, yeah.
Your product is that little flower that, you know, if the Mario gets that, it grows up, it becomes bigger and just starts shooting things and kills
people. That's a great analogy.
And exactly. It was very simple and it's, you know, it resonated well with me. And every time I meet with my teams or our customers, we always kind of use that analogy and focus on how can we make you better? How can our product actually empower you? So that's exciting and definitely resonates with what you're talking about from that innovation standpoint.
Yeah, agreed. I think it happens constantly. Like if you're on it from a product perspective and a thought leadership perspective, you're always innovating. But again, I think sometimes people put too much weight into how do we become the next Uber or fill in the blank? It's like, that's a one in a 10 million, right? We right. just got to be the best at what we do and bring innovation. And so, I'm sure you're familiar with this one, but I always loved Henry Ford's notion about, you know, if I asked my customers what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse. And so we talk about that a lot. Like, I do need to give you a faster horse, but I also need to be working on the automobile. And right. once I get the automobile, I got to be working on urban air mobility or whatever it is, right? But so we've got to be ahead of where our clients are because they've got day jobs and they've got outcomes they're responsible for, whatever industry. So the responsibility, I think, lies on us to be pushing and moving ahead, but still not losing sight of the important day-to-day features and functionality that we need to make their lives better.
Right, right, right. No, absolutely. I love those examples. Which leads me to the next question is when, you know, I'm just like yourself, you know, I'm very entrepreneurial. I've always, you know, I've been on the corporate side, founded my own companies, but it's always kind of the premise behind this is, you know, the different ideas and trends that really excite you these days. Yeah. It doesn't necessarily have to be in your space, in the staffing or VMS, but curious to get your take on what are you extremely passionate about these days? What do you think is the next big thing? What are you looking to invest in or perhaps implement in your organization or for yourself?
Okay, fair question. There's a lot there. So yeah. I think I'll go to one of my principles that talent is talent, period. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think in our industry, too much we focused on full-time and non-full-time. And what I always say is, look, whether you come as a full-time colleague or a temporary worker, a contingent worker, variable, extended workforce, whatever we want to call it, whatever moniker we latch onto, at the end of the day, we're hiring talent to produce something. Again, it could be a service or product. And it's just, the government taxes differently. So that's why we categorize it. And, you know, one may be variable, one not. But at the end of the day, we have to recognize, at least in my opinion, that it's all about people. And I think we've gotten too far into the, here's the different workflows. And in my mind, the real problem we're trying to solve is to match you with great talent that will produce those great outcomes. So what am I passionate about? The standard model is right now to go through staffing firms, and it's a great model and it works, but there is an opportunity to go directly to talent. Should it be 100%? Absolutely not. Staffing firms have a very important role in the ecosystem, but there are certain jobs and certain geographies where it makes a ton of sense to create a private talent pool and to tap into that on a variable basis. So that's an area that I feel strongly about. Frequently, folks in our industry talk about total talent management, and I do feel like that's a lot of marketing talk. Is there legitimacy to the notion? There is. Mm-hmm. And it isn't so much a software challenge, it's a political challenge within the organization. So you've got HR, for the most part, that owns the full-time workforce. Mm-hmm. And then often procurement, strategic sourcing, IT, you know, other factions will own the variable side. And so it's difficult to think in terms of how do I optimize, and this is what I call optimizing your workforce, less about total talent management, until I really get tight on the full-time side and then tight on the non-full-time side. So what I challenge our clients in the industry to do is get your arms around your non-full-time side. Let's properly classify them. Let's start to look at alternative channels, sourcing, like direct sourcing. Mm-hmm. And once we've done that, then we can look at the data and start doing some of the neat things. So the other areas I'm passionate about is the resume should be dead. It's not, but it should be. We're way past that. And we have skill attributes we can pull out of people that can manifest in this software. Right. Job descriptions are terrible. And yet they're the bedrock of what we put into the VMS, but we wonder why staffing firms take time to source or why the MSPs or the internal program offices have to basically distill down what the job description is to actionable attributes for the staffing firms. It's because they're no good. Mm-hmm. And we're a little bit lazy, frankly. We load them up and we just off to the races. So there's a lot of work we can also do through the machine learning of understanding a project manager in Fort Lauderdale to John may be different to what one is for Doug up in Jacksonville, right? And, mm-hmm. and the system should know that because we've done enough hiring to understand and discern what that means to you. So, you know, reinventing the way we assess people, the way we match people, the way we even understand the buyer, much less the organization. These are the things that we're focused on from an innovative perspective that I think hold great promise and are really, really fun.
Well, that's super exciting. And I love what you said about, you know, the resume being dead, because at the end of the day, everything is overhyped and overrepresented on every resume, you know, for valid reasons. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, it's not something that's really gonna, it may get you in the door, but, you know, as far as your actual, you know, abilities to perform, your abilities to build that, you know, relationship with the person you're interviewing, I think goes way beyond what's on paper. So that's super exciting. And then the other piece, what you were talking about, I think you mentioned direct sourcing, where an organization can actually tap into, I guess, the talent pools directly and try to source directly from there. Is there for an organization, I guess, of a small to medium size, like a startup, what would you recommend as far as them taking advantage of this particular concept and going directly to the talent pools? And is there a lot of tools available out there? What's the best route for them?
Yeah, look, I don't know about the best route. I know of some. It's not a, we don't do a lot of business with the smaller firms or the startups yet, you know, maybe at some point, but we're heavily focused on the enterprise. But I have some degree of understanding of what's out there. So, for example, Crowd Staffing is a company based out of San Francisco, and they do a really nice job almost providing VMS-like capabilities, but with an array of recruiters. So in essence, you're crowd staffing, right? And kind of leveraging the same principles that you would with creating a private talent pool. So they work with smaller companies. And I'm sorry, I'm blanking. There's some others that are well-suited to come in and basically, like TalentNet, they could come in and basically just set up a private talent pool for you that you could begin to reuse over and over again. And I think there's a real need for that demographic that you've described. It's not one that we've tapped into right now, but I know the need is out there. And to the extent that organizations can effectively go out and find specific talent and create massive talent pools and then maybe micro talent pools, I think there's real opportunity. But one of the things I tried to push early on was get less married to this notion of a private talent pool and just tap into a public talent pool. Mm-hmm. But a lot of my clients came back and said, well, I don't want to share my talent. I don't want to be working with other customers. I'm like, but you don't own that talent. They're not even full-time people. You ought to open up your horizons a bit and just have a big public talent pool that anybody can source through and trade off, et cetera. And I think the industry is going in that direction, but I think you'll also see more niche talent pools. And so there'll be strong providers that come and say, look, we just have acumen around data scientists, or we just announced a project that we're doing right now, the diversity talent pool with the MOM Project, a great organization. And so they in essence are going to fuel the diversity talent pool for us. So that's another channel that I could take to my clients. And so I think you'll see a pop-up of a bunch of niche firms, which makes a lot of sense. And I think you'll see staffing firms actually start to migrate and say, hey, look, the world's changed a bit. We're really good at this, this, and this. And so we can build a public or a private talent pool with you know, our resources. That's just my thought.
No, absolutely. It makes perfect sense, especially, you know, creating these little expertise areas or domain areas, you know, where you specialize in. Because at the end of the day, that's how you build a relationship with a potential candidate, is that if you essentially the practitioner or you specialize in that space, if I'm a candidate, I'll probably be more lenient to talk to you because you know what it takes, you know, the intricacies of, you know, getting the job in this space or succeeding in a career versus if I was in IT and you were in finance, probably would be, you know, harder for me to build that gap, you know, build that bridge with you. So that makes perfect sense. In your previous response, you briefly mentioned some opportunities around leveraging advanced technologies such as machine learning, artificial intelligence, and so forth. And we all know it's, you know, it's not, you know, it's a buzzword, but it's not a new concept. It's been around, but they're reinventing different industries, you know, information technology, you know, in general. How do you think these advanced technologies will impact your industry from innovation standpoint? And more importantly, I talked to a lot of executives and a lot of them definitely want to, you know, explore that. But the bigger question becomes is what are some of the best practices when it comes to actually leveraging and implementing such technologies? Curious to get your take on that.
Yeah, I think first we do have to be somewhat careful and understand how real is it, whatever this solution is, it's AI driven. I see a lot of AI-driven platform. Like, what does that mean? Other than, you know, you're trying to look modern and cool and sexy. And I get all that. There's a place for marketing. But, you know, in my opinion, it all rests on data. Like, you've got to have a massive amount of data. And that's something that I take very seriously. And we do have a massive amount of data. We've got, I'm not trying to sell here. I'm just, you know, to back up what I believe in. We've got about $500 billion of spend over the last 20 years that we can draw off of. But I'm not satisfied with that. Like, I think it's important to go out to external sources as well. Some folks think that my data is enough, you know, within their domain. I don't believe you can have too much data. So I'm working with other partners to augment that so that we can then go in and start to discern patterns. And sometimes it's exploratory. You know, I think in our industry, the big buzz is, well, we've got a proprietary algorithm that matches candidates. Like, everybody has a proprietary algorithm, supposedly. I still haven't seen it work that well. And I still think we have a lot of work to do. You brought up really what you were saying with soft skills, and that's really, really important. VMSs, applicant tracking systems, resumes, they do a nice job looking at the hard skills, the skill attributes, experience, et cetera. But we still need to have a better understanding of how well that individual will fit in the organization. There's psychometrics that can help with that, but you don't typically see them integrated with some of the solutions. And these are some of the things I'm looking at. So, you know, look, to be frank, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that we've conquered the matching or that stuff. But what I will tell you is we've discerned some really, really interesting things in buying behavior. And I don't want to go into too much detail on that one right now because, A, it's in its nascency and I'm just starting to work on it in beta with some of my closest clients. But we're coming out with some, I think, some really neat stuff that shows that there's still more savings to be gained because some of the buying behavior, we can point to the data, isn't in line with what you want it to be. And we can help that. So I believe the VMS has to be more of what I call concierge software. Mm-hmm. It's fine that it does workflow, but that's not enough. It was good 10, 15 years ago. Understand me better than maybe I understand me. Understand how I buy, what I'm doing right, what I'm doing wrong, where my biases are, where I've had successful matches, et cetera. And then present opportunities for me to mimic positive behavior and reduce negative behavior. So when you ask me about AI and ML, it's much more database that's looked at some exploratory work that says, where do we see behavioral clusters and what can we do about them? And if there are big gaps in terms of positive behaviors versus negative, how do I manifest that in a way that's elegant through the UX and lead someone gently to make better decisions for their organization. And I know I'm talking a little bit high level just because I don't want to get into too specific details until we launch this in the next 3-4 months. But these are the things I'm focused in on right now from an AI and an ML perspective. And again, I think AI, you've heard people talk about artificial intelligence and some people talk about augmented intelligence. We would favor more augmented intelligence. I still think people matter at this point. I think they'll always matter. I think there's a lot of information I can give you, but I would be loath to say, wipe my hands and just let the machine tell me that John's coming to work on Monday and he's the answer to all my solutions. And maybe I'm old fashioned, right. But that's where I am right now, at least.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. That makes perfect sense. And especially where you talk about that, you know, the human element will always be present there. It's, you know, we're probably, you know, I don't want to say light years, but we years away from where, you know, the actual, you know, the computer generated algorithm can really predict certain behaviors or be able to, you know, effectively, I don't know, select a particular candidate for a given role. I think there's the human element is very strong. It's, you know, certain parts can be automated, but it's definitely, to your point, something that's, you know, we'll be present there for a while.
Yeah, I think our approach is just to manifest information that you look at and say, that makes a lot of sense, but you still have authority to go that direction or not, as opposed to just taking away that responsibility altogether. I think that's a bit dangerous right now.
Oh, for sure. For sure. That makes perfect sense. So to take that a little bit further with, you know, you being a thought leader in this space and, you know, obviously you spent quite a few years in staffing in general, I want to go back to some of the basics. When it comes to actual interviewing, you know, let's take a case for your organization, for Beeline. When, you know, a particular candidate comes in, you're the CEO, they probably go through multiple rounds of interviews, technical assessments, and so forth. When they get to the top and they sit in front of Doug and there's an interview, give us a glimpse into that. What does the interview look like? Do you get creative with it? Do you keep it pretty traditional? But more importantly, what do you look for in some of the responses?
Okay, that's a good question. I mean, you're right. At the end of the day, sorry, excuse me one second. I did bring my dog to work today since no one's showing up. She's actually eating this magazine with my face on, so she's trying to destroy it and has
Oh, no way. You're on the cover.
And I'm not that arrogant. It just happens to be here because we moved offices and she found it. I don't typically have pictures of myself around. The interview question. Look, you're right. Like by the time someone gets to me, they've been vetted. And I've got 9 principles that I put in place back in 2010 that we still hold true today for the organization. But it's also important to vet people against those 9. So what I'm really looking for in our dialogue at that level is authenticity and introspection. It's just absolutely paramount to me. And I've often said to folks, look, I don't need a bunch of renegade cowboys or A-plus players. I'll take a great collaborator with B-plus skills any day over those folks. Now, I happen to think there's A players that also show great emotional intelligence and know how to collaborate well. So I think we've done a great job finding those people. But, you know, our conversation is going to be more like, John, just tell me, you know, what you're not good at. And believe it or not, that's not that easy for some people. So then I'll reframe and say, well, let's take a different path. What do you suck at? Like, what do you not enjoy? Because then I can start to get a sense. And it's not that I'm trying to weed you out. I'm trying to make sure that we've done a good job figuring out if we've properly cast you in the organizations. And there've been times where I'm like, look, honestly, we've done a good job. Culturally, you're a home run here. That role maybe not make as much sense as we thought. This role could make more sense. So I need to understand transferable skills and how you've addressed failure in the past. If you're want to blame, that doesn't work very well for me. If you point that finger internally and take a lot of accountability and responsibility, you're going to do really well in the organization. Right. Also, what do you want? You know, I'm just trying to get a sense of who the person is and, you know, what they're looking for. And if, you know, oftentimes when we do our surveys, hear things like, well, you know, there's not rigid career pathing here. I'm like, exactly. I'm not looking for that. I'm looking for a bunch of entrepreneurial go-getting people that make their own path and have a way of showing transferable skills, as I just mentioned, do great with leadership or not, you know, that's okay. Not everybody's to be a leader, but manifest those skills that are going to feed your soul. And then those opportunities will start to present themselves. But the biggest thing, you know, that I talk about here is direct communication and assume positive intent. And if you can do that, you're going to thrive. And if you can't, then we've done a poor job vetting you, you miscast and you know, we're probably gonna have to walk out the door pretty shortly because people can't become cancerous around here. Culture is too dang important to me.
Oh, I love that. One thing that really stood out is the positive intent. It's, you know, if you don't have that outlook onto, especially when you're collaborating with others, I think it's going to be very challenging, regardless of your skills. And if you don't assume that positive intent, it's, you know, something that I'm working on very hard on that as well, especially when, you know, you move from meetings to meetings, you move from projects to projects, you deal with different personalities. It's always, you know, something, you know, I love that. I love what you just said about it.
It's funny you say that, because when I do our surveys, typically the thing that's written about the most, what people love about the company, is they say, we love the assume positive intent principle. And to your point, we get very busy, and sometimes we create the ozone stories and like, well, John said that because he's just mad about, or in the email, I completely misread it because John and I had a little tussle the other day, as opposed to, you know, look, man, we got in a tussle, no big deal. Like you said, you got young kids. They made life a little bit tough last night. You came to work tired. It happens all the time. Right. So I think, you know, you've got to have confidence to assume positive intent. And I always tell people, if you want to come in here and bitch about somebody for 5 minutes, you get 5 minutes to bitch. Then I'm going to say, what did they say when you told them about how you feel? Uh-huh. Because if you do a good job hiring, and I think we do, we hire great people and we all have the same end game. We want to be successful and put food on our family's plates. So no one's trying to take you down. And it's so arrogant to think that I would spend my time trying to take you down. Like if you actually think that, then you think the world revolves around you. And sadly, it doesn't. So it's like, get out of your head, recognize it ain't about you, and go have a conversation. And so, look, I do a lot of coaching on that. And I have to your point, look inside a lot and say, I'm not practicing what I preach. I brought some baggage into that scenario. And so I'm challenging myself all the time.
I love that. And, you know, I love the aspect of making a conversation and really allowing the candidate actually ask you questions, and almost a two-way interview for them to be able to assess, you know, who's the leadership, who's leading the organization, who am I joining? I think that's of extreme importance. And I love what you were saying in terms of really opening up about, you know, that self-awareness aspect in terms of, are you aware of, you know, your surroundings? Are you aware of your weaknesses? And more importantly, almost if I was to call your current or previous manager, what do you think they will say is your weakness? That way you're also aware of what others think that you're not good at. So I think those are great points you're making when it comes to the actual interview. I love that. I'm pretty sure we can spend the whole podcast episode talking about this. But just moving on from kind of your outlook onto current state of the industry as far as the most in-demand skill sets out there that are very hard to find. I'm curious to get your take on that. What do you see from whether your clients or the industry research perspective? Which ones are the most challenging? The reason I ask that question is because a good portion of our audience are, you know, early stage career professionals, second year MBAs, and a lot of questions we get is from our guest's perspective. If I was to choose a particular area, let's say within IT, what would that be in the current situation? So curious to get your expert opinion on that.
I mean, the hot skills are definitely in IT, as you say, and it's all thing digital transformation, which is a big moniker to mean a lot of things. But, you know, it seems as if agile methodology, Scrum Masters, cloud, microservices, anything in that realm is super hot. And, you know, we're seeing the rates increase precipitously on those positions for good reason. And look, I'm going through my own digital transformation within Beeline. You know, we need to be modernizing ourselves continuously. So look, I understand the question in the client's context, but we suffer from it as well. And I'm fortunate that I've got several offices. So, you know, if you can't find somebody in Jacksonville, you can find somebody in Denver or in Philippines or over in Europe. So that helps, but there's definitely a high demand for those skills. And I think that lends itself well to the variable workforce as well. I often talk about data scientists, for example. There's a lot of need I have in that department, but hiring a full team of data scientists is very expensive and hard and difficult, especially in Jacks, less so maybe in Denver. And so, you know, I do some outsourcing or I hire contractors for that type of stuff. So those are the hot skills that we ourselves suffer from and that our clients are suffering from as well. And that's why I said earlier, if I were to start a staffing firm, I would think about focusing in a big way, niche in digital transformation and creating a series of talent pools that I would then share with people and let them go directly and maybe change the model from the traditional one today and have this, let somebody have access to that. So that's what I'm seeing, and that's how I think about it.
Absolutely. I, you know, couldn't agree more with you from that perspective. You know, transformation is, you know, whether digital, people, or, you know, the business transformation in general, it requires definitely, you know, specialized skill set, whether you're, you know, in data cybersecurity or, you know, cloud engineering and so forth. I think it definitely makes sense that being a very
security is another huge one. Yeah, sorry, I should have. That's probably even higher than the other ones.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It makes perfect sense. So when it comes to that specific, very in-demand, hard-to-find skill set, what strategies help you attract that type of talent to your organization? What have you tried and that did not work? Share with us some of the experiences there.
Look, I'll circle back to where we started. That's culture is everything. And I sometimes tell this story. Years ago, I walked in the Apple store and I bought my daughter the iPhone or whatever. You know, so the guy was sending the receipt to me and I said, just doug.leiby@beeline.com. And he looked at me and goes, you work for Beeline? I said, yeah. And he said, it's funny, I moved from, I don't remember where. And there were only two companies I wanted to work for, Apple and Beeline. And no offense, Apple was number one and I got the job. It's like, none taken, that's a huge company. But it's interesting because, you know, generationally, that's very different from how I grew up. And it was all about glass doors. So he searched for tech firms in the area with high ratings and was able to dig into the culture, which again, I think is really important because at the end of the day, people want to matter. They want to learn. They want to grow. They want to feel supported. And so we have a lot of referrals. I do have an internal recruiter who actually two of them who are very, very good. But I know that they rely heavily on our culture, on our Glassdoor ratings, and having them talk with folks in the organization. And as I said, a lot of people come into us from our own people. It's like this, we don't pay the highest amount, but you know, it's a special place in my opinion. And I'm sending out notes. I always send anniversary and birthday notes to people. But if you've been 15 years or more, I send one out to the company. And I probably sent out 30 this year of 15, 20 years or more. So I think, you know, retention and tenure is a big issue, and there's a reason behind that. And it is about respecting the individual and creating an opportunity to flourish. And again, you're not going to become a millionaire here. I'm sure you go out to San Francisco and double your salary. It's not a problem. But if you're looking for a little bit more soul fulfillment and developmental growth and just a place where you feel really supported and with a great team of people, that's how you attract people. And more importantly, that's how you keep people, I think.
I love that. And, you know, it's simple, but oftentimes overlooked component of really, you know, developing that strategy to attract the top talent to your organization. You know, it's not necessarily having all the best perks in the world or, you know, fancy offices and all of that great stuff.
Yeah.
It all boils down to the type of culture, the type of, you know, the people that, you know, you deal with on a daily basis, who's at the leadership. So that's very important. I love that you highlight that from that standpoint. Doug, in general, share with us, what are your sources for information? What are your sources for learning? What are you, whether it's a blog that you subscribe to or it's a Twitter profile that you religiously follow, just curious to get your perspective on your content diet perspective. Where do you consume your information from?
I think I'm a bit anemic in this realm and I'm going to embarrass myself. And maybe this is a function of age, but I'm even embarrassed to do this and tell you that I don't listen to a lot of podcasts. So it's probably an area for 2021 I need to look at. But I read a lot. I've got great avarice in terms of reading books. Or I should say listening, because most of my stuff is done on Audible at this point. Uh-huh. And then the newspaper. So I think I'm like old school, man. You need someone more hip, younger, and cooler to talk about the podcasts and the Twitters and all that stuff, or the, you know, Twitter profiles. But really for me, it's just staying current in terms of what's happening in our industry with some of the, you know, things that come out from an industry perspective, like SIA or a lot of the bankers that, you know, we're in the private equity world, we're owned by private equity. A lot of the bankers I talk to, and they keep me apprised of what's happening in the markets and really in HR tech. Mm-hmm. They do extensive research, which is very, very helpful. And then I just have a wide array of interests in terms of the books that I read. So some are business oriented, but many are not. But that's predominantly how I.
Right. That's awesome. I love that. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I actually, you know, look, these are my new ones for the next quarter.
I got Blue Ocean as well. I'm reading that as well. Or I did.
Atomic Habits.
I've got that one as well. Yep.
It was highly recommended. So on that note, what are you currently reading? And is there a particular book that you always recommend to others? And if so, why is that?
There really isn't. If I think about this, there'd be, let's think, four categories maybe that I break my reading down into. Uh-huh. One would just be fun and escape. So the Brad Thors, you know, the sort of assassin CIA stuff. Like I love that stuff. The next would be history. I'm a history major, so I love all things history. I just finished a book on Churchill, which was fantastic. The book that Isaacson did on Leonardo da Vinci was phenomenal. You know, just I love that kind of stuff. The next one I'd say business. So your blue ocean, you know, leadership. There's a great book Marcus Buckingham put out, Nine Lives of Work. If you'd ask me one of the books I've recommended the most over the years, it would be First Break All the Rules. Mm. And you probably never heard of it because it's about a 30-year-old book. But it was Marcus Buckingham, and he really started to tap into culture. And back when I was getting my master's in HR, this was a top of mind for me. And the guy's just nailed it. And he's done a lot of research around the nine lies of work, which I think is super fascinating. And then the last one would just be bestsellers. You know, Educated, Hillbilly Elegy, Untamed, stuff like that, just to keep current. So a wide array of things. So I'm actually reading several books right now. One is By Way of Deception. It's an ex-Israeli Mossad officer who's sort of a telltale. He did this back in the 80s, so it's a bit dated, but it's pretty fascinating. And then I picked up another book on Churchill just because I loved The Splendid and the Vile so much. And then I just finished Killing Crazy Horse, which is all about the horrific treatment of the Native Americans back in the late 1800s. So, you know, kind of across the board.
Wow, you're all over the place. It's a very diverse, you know, reading profile, which is...
Well, I'll tell you a funny story. I read a book years ago, and this guy, he was kind of full of it, but I didn't know at the time. And he said, CEOs on average read 50 books a year. I was like, 50 books? I'm reading like 25. I'm way behind. So I set this goal. And I learned that that's not actually true. I think he was referring to Bill Gates, who, fair enough, I'm no Bill Gates, right? But I did 52 that year. And I haven't kept up to that, but Audible's made it a lot easier because I can jack that speed up to 70 or 80% and still understand what they're saying and rip through a lot more material that way.
I love that. I love those recommendations. Doug, I know you're a very busy guy. You gotta go plan for 2021 and the next period for you. Can't thank you enough for your time today. It was a very short and very powerful conversation. I personally learned quite a bit. I definitely look forward to staying in touch with you. Perhaps we could do another episode later this year and see how much have transpired.
Anytime. You're a lot of fun, and I enjoyed getting to know you the last couple of weeks and doing this with you as well. So I wish you the best of 2021.
Thanks so much, Doug. Likewise.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.